And we will go back and re-record that presentation in its entirety, so it will be available. We'll now have our second presenter, an associate in the United Lodge of Theosophists in San Diego.
Do we want to take a chat now or not?
We're going to take chats during our question and answer period.
Okay, all right.
Well, hi, everybody. I'm Jonathan Colbert, in case you don't know me. I figured that out because I looked at my screen right there and it said that. And I am going to give my presentation on kind of taking a different zoomed out perspective. And I appreciate what Steve provided us with, just that incredible two takeaways, at least that I'm going to be thinking about, is the electromagnetism and also the cosmic dust. Wow, that is quite an interesting aspect. So I will be sharing my screen here, and I'm going to be doing a keynote sort of presentation. And I need your feedback. I'm going to admit.
We see you. We see your presentation.
Okay, now do you see all my slides on the left corner right there? In other words, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, where my arrow is.
We do see your slides.
I wonder if I'm going to hit, what happens if I hit play? Now what happens?
They disappear.
Oh my. Okay. Me and computers, it's always kind of like Mr. Magoo. Okay. So speaking of this zoomed out perspective, I will be starting with something of a mythological approach. Then I guess you call it occultism, but the information in the stanzas of Zion having to do with cataclysms and karma. And then ending with, I guess you would call it a moral imperative, or at least a strong theosophical suggestion that seems to come out of this. So, a lot of times we think of Vishnu as being the great preserver in nature. And obviously Earth Day and Theosophical Ecology and so forth would have to do with preservation of our world. But also Shiva is considered to be the good gardener of nature. And Shiva is that witness that sees all of time and is not affected by the cycles, and yet participates in preservation by means of destruction and regeneration. And throughout the course of this little presentation, we will see that these crisis points that Steve has been alluding to have already taken place many times on this globe. But they have to do with the different phases of human growth. So let's see here. I'm going to take you to an aspect of Shiva, which is a figure in the Ramayana and in the Yoga Vashista of Basunda. So that is Shiva as the divine witness. And Basunda sits in the eternal Kalpa tree. And the Kalpa tree is a place, a mysterious place in mythology, that you can see all of time and all the cyclic vicissitudes of time coming and going. And I'll read from the Yoga Vashista just a little bit, and it will tell us a little bit about this Kalpa tree. Basunda said, "This Kalpa tree whereon we dwell stands firm and unshaken amidst the revolution of ages and the all-destroying blasts of tempests and conflagrations. This great arbor, this great tree, is inaccessible to beings who dwell in other worlds. Therefore, we reside here in perfect peace and bliss apart from all disturbance. When Hiranyaksha the giant demon of the antediluvian race, strove to hurl this earth with all its seven continents into the lowest abyss, even then did this tree stand firm on its roots at the summit of this mountain. And then when this mountainous abode of the gods stood trembling with all the other mountains of the earth, upon Viraha's tusk, this tree remained unshaken. So then Vasistha is the one talking to Bastunda. Yoga Vasistha is the one talking to Bashunda, which is really Shiva. Vasistha says, Lord, you are as enduring as our salvation is long lasting, and are able to guide us in the depths of truth, because established in true wisdom and steady in the intent of yoga. You who have seen the many changes of the world and experienced all things through the repeated course of creations are best able to tell of the wonders to be witnessed during the revolutions of the ages. Bhasunda replies, he says, I remember, O great sage, the earth beneath this Mount Meru to have once been a desolate land, having no hills, rocks, trees, plants, or even grasses upon it. I remember also this earth under me to have been full of ashes for a period of myriads of centuries and mortal years. I remember seeing no life on earth except for the vegetable creation through the duration of one half of the four yuga ages. I also recall this earth to have been full of mountains and mountainous tracts for the space of full four yugas, when no men peopled the earth and human customs and usages had gained no ground on it. I remember seeing this earth filled with the bones of the dead daichas and other fossil remains, rising in heaps like mountains and continuing in their dilapidated and crumbling state for myriads of years. So that's what Bhasunda could see from the kalpa tree. Let's see here. Here we go. Let me make sure that I, yep. So from here forward, I will be just reading with you and to you, and it'll be like a study, not so much my synthesis, but just a study in different passages of the second volume of The Secret Doctrine. And I will also quote from William Kwan Judge, mainly his article on the future, A Few Reflections, and his article that he put together of the 31 aphorisms on karma. Let's see here, I got it. I want to get rid of this.
Just minimize it. I can't see the cursor.
Yeah, it's amazing. Give me a second here.
You just want to get to right there.
I don't know how to get there.
Can I try
it? Yeah, go for it. I'll just try and figure it out. Yeah, you can drag it down. Yep, that does the trick. Thank you. So in The Secret Doctrine, in the second volume, it talks about the seven races which occur in the fourth round of human and the evolution of nature, visible and invisible. And the races are in reference to stages of human spiritual and moral and mental development. My understanding is that they have very little to do with the physical races of humanity. So these are seven stages of human growth. They are marked by seven great cycles. You could even make the case that these seven stages have to do with the cycles of seven in the human life. And if a human being has cycles of seven, as is suggested by Shakespeare, so also humanity has this great cycle of seven periods of growth and learning. These seven races are also marked by seven pralayas. Normally in theosophy, when we speak of pralayas, there is a total rendering of manifestation to become homogeneous and unmanifest. But really, Manvantara and pralaya refer to periods of activity and sleep. These pralayas, therefore, are what HPB calls terrestrial pralayas. So in other words, the earth doesn't go away. There's just a period of relative non-manifestation of humanity, relative. So therefore, the surface of our globe is subject to seven periodical entire changes. So the whole surface becomes entirely changed seven times throughout this period of the growth of humanity on this earth. And they go pari passu, which is side by side, with these races. And between each of these cycles, there are pralayas occasioned by a change in the inclination of the Earth's axis. Now, I underlined this idea of the Earth's axis because that's going to be a recurring theme here. Everyone knows, or most people know, about the precession of the equinoxes, which has to do with a natural 26,000 year cycle, 25,800 and something or other cycle, where the tilting of the Earth's axis wobbles, you could say, but in a measured and metered way. And therefore, right now, our axis points towards the North Star, but that hasn't always been the case. And in 25,000 years hence, my understanding is that it will return to that position as it circles around. So that is a great and graceful, majestic turning of the axis of the Earth. Now, these quotes are mostly from The Secret Doctrine. I might have changed the tense of the quote just to make it a little more readable. So these changes in geology are also attended by changes in mankind in general. Every event of universal importance, such as geological cataclysms at the end of one race and the beginning of a new one, involving great change each time in mankind. Somebody going to admit, Johanna? Thanks. So there are these great changes in mankind, spiritually, morally, and physically. Now, here's something very interesting. All these changes are precogitated and preconcerted. These are HPB's words. Where are they done so? In the sidereal regions of our planetary system. Suffice it to say here that the Earth is sevenfold, just like a human being is sevenfold. And just as there are changes in the non-physical principles which reflect themselves in the changes on the physical, just so that is true with the Earth. But there is so much in this idea about the sidereal regions. That could include astrology, that could include astronomy, etc. The face of the globe is completely changed each time. Old continents, except for the first one, are sucked in by the oceans. Other lands appear, huge mountain chains arise where there are none before. Let me see. Now, here's a very interesting quote from the stanzas of Zion in the second volume of The Secret Doctrine. And it has to do with the rate of rotation of the earth spinning on its axis. It says, when the wheel runs at the usual rate, the wheel is the earth in this case, its extremities, the poles, agree with its middle circle, the equator. However, it can slow down. So when it runs slower and tilts in every direction, there's a great disturbance on the face of the earth. So my understanding of this, and others may have different understandings of this, is that just as there's that great 25,000 year, very majestic pirouette that the earth's axis is doing over this great period of time, it's like a top. Have you ever seen a top? And yes, the axis of the spin does change, but also it vibrates. The top vibrates such that there are speedings up and slowings down depending on the vibration of the top. And just so, the earth does that too, according to this teaching of occultism here. So then it's saying that when the great disturbance on the face of the earth happens and the wheel slows down, the waters flow toward the two ends, namely towards the poles, and new lands arise in the middle belt. So a person may be able to explain that physically, but my understanding is that when something is going faster, then the waters would be higher in the middle. Whereas if it's slowing down, then the centrifugal force of the faster spin would be such that water, in this case, would be slowed down and would no longer be a bulge in the middle of the earth and would recede towards the two poles. So it's so interesting. There's so many variables. Now, there are hints in the Secret Doctrine that these rates of rotation have to do with human thought, and we're going to get to that later. So, therefore, thus the wheel, the earth, is subject to and regulated by the spirit of the moon, for the breath of its waters, the tides, towards the close of the age, which is a kalpa, of a great root race, the regions of the moon, the Pitar fathers or Pitris, begin drawing harder and thus flatten the wheel about its belt when it goes down in some places and swells in others. And the swelling, running toward the extremities, poles, new lands will arise and old ones be sucked in. Now, there is some discussion in science right now, in earth science, that they're talking about axial drift. So in other words, the axis of the earth, the spin axis, moves 4 inches per year, but is mysteriously subject to change in direction. So it's not predictable, at least not yet. The speculation is that it has to do with three things. One is that as the poles are melting, especially the North Pole and especially Greenland, then the sheer weight of all this water and ice on Greenland, and as Steve is pointing out, you know, gradually on Antarctica as well, changes the mass of the earth right there. This is contemporary science. In other words, it changes the shape of the Earth right there slightly enough to instigate this 4 degrees in alteration. In other words, if you're sitting on a mattress and then you stand up, then there's no more weight on that mattress. And that affects the axis to some extent, very slightly. And my understanding is that these slight axis changes are equivalent, or at least point to that vibration in the analogy of the top. Another aspect is as the poles melt, and especially Greenland, then that does a dispersion of the weight equation. It's no longer a whole lot of weight in one spot in Greenland. All that water is going out uniformly throughout the globe. That's another aspect that affects these axis changes. And then these same Earth scientists are saying that the beneath the crust of the Earth, there are changes that take place in the, what's the second layer down below the crust? I just had it in my mind. Anyway, the next layer down, which is a lot more fluid.
Mantle,
thank you. Thank you very much, Steve. And so there are changes in the mantle. And these in turn are probably regulated to some extent by the changes in the Earth's magnetism, as was alluded to before. So historically, there have been 4 axial disturbances so far. And these are, my understanding is that these are much larger axial disturbances than can be attributed to the precession of the equinoxes and also to these minor, we'll call them vibrations of axial drift. There are radical axial disturbances, and they have happened between all of the races, the cycles of humanity's major periods of growth and learning. That worlds, also races, are periodically destroyed by fire, which is volcanoes and earthquakes, and water in turn. We'll talk more about fire and water in a minute. And then renewed is a doctrine as old as man. As to the question of the 4 distinct races of mankind that preceded our 5th race, there's nothing mystical in it except the ethereal bodies of the first races. The legends, therefore, are as historically correct as they are universal. The Mexicans, for example, had and still have the tradition of the fourfold destruction of the world by fire and water, just as the Egyptians had, and as the Hindus have, even to this day. Manu, Hermes, the Chaldees, all antiquity believed in this. So there's this teaching that the races are terminated and reset by huge transforming elements of fire and water. So they are alternately, so in other words, the Atlantean race is said to have been destroyed by water, right? Noah's Ark. But before that, presumably, the Lemurian cycle would have been destroyed by fire. And before that, I believe, Hyperborean cycle would have been changed by water. And before that, by fire. Now, normally, in that other slide, she's referring to fires being volcanoes and earthquakes, and water as being the change of the position of land in relation to water. So twice has the face of the globe been changed, and I wrote it in this word transformed, by fire, and twice by water, since man appeared on it. As land needs rest and renovation, that's the Shiva element, new forces and a change for its soil, so does water. Thence arises a periodical redistribution of land and water, change of climates, etc., all brought on by geological revolution and ending in a final change in the axis. Now, if you think of, first of all, Steve already mentioned something about the four elements. Many times in mystical literature and in theosophy and the secret doctrine, etc., the elements are also referred to their living spiritual side of each element. But either way, no matter what level you look at fire or water, it's they're both, especially fire, are elements of transformation. Fire transforms matter into heat and smoke and ash. But water is transformative too. Water dissolves that which affects. So there's different kinds of renovation, transformation, etc., that happen between these periods of learning for humanity. So here is something from Judge, and he's talking about the five great continents, but in reality, interestingly, he's talking about the seven great continents. And this is from an article called On the Future, A Few Reflections. He says, first, there's the imperishable sacred land. This is at the North Pole. Second, the Hyperborean. Now part of it is in Northern Asia. Okay, interesting. See, HPV and Judge, they just throw out these hints. And many, many times, if you want to learn about the fourth, you'll find it where she's writing about it in the third or the fifth. So there's so much light, perhaps, in all of these teachings that maybe one can't look directly at the light. So there's all these kind of allusions and poetic allegories and so forth. So the third great cycle of human learning is the Lemurian cycle, which is sunk long ago, but leaving some remains, islands, the points of high mountain ranges, etc. Fourth, we have Atlantis, presumably in the Atlantic Ocean, now below the level of the water, but with perhaps Tenerife and Atlas as reminders. And fifth, he's quoting the secret doctrine, was America. Now, right away, he starts talking about preparation for the sixth great race, and that'll last throughout the whole sixth and seventh sub-races of the fifth race. But the last remnants of the fifth continent will not disappear until sometime after the birth of the new race, when another and a new dwelling, so all these great continents are considered to be places of dwelling. You could possibly look at them as classrooms for human learning. So this new dwelling is the sixth continent, and it will have appeared above the new waters on the face of the globe so as to receive the new stranger. So there is the preparation of these continents who are to receive different cycles of humanity. To it also will emigrate and settle all those who shall be fortunate enough to escape the general disaster. When this shall be, as just said, is not for the writer to know. That's classic Judge. Sorry about such a suddenly bright slide. So then, in reference to the sixth race, which is the future, Judge writes, the present America is not the actual continent as it is to be. It is a portion of it, and certainly is now the nursery for the race that will be in the future occupy the sixth continent, which for the sixth great root race will emerge from the waters, where, perhaps, when the present America has been split up by tremendous cataclysms, leaving here and there large pieces on its western side. It is in the Pacific Ocean that the great mass of the new one will come up from the long sleep below the sea. There will be no more Americans. In other words, the people in those given land masses will not identify as Americans as such. When the six races commences, no more, in fact, than Europeans. People will not identify as Europeans as such, for they will now become a new race. Somebody could admit, Dotson. A new race for many hundreds, thousands of years to come, and it will be transformed with it. So this, the remnants of the fifth race will be transformed slower than the existing sixth race, but still getting entirely altered in mentality, general physique, and stature. So at the physical level, mankind will not grow again into giant bodies, as in the case of the Lemurians and the Atlanteans, because while the evolution of the fourth race led the latter down to the very bottom of materiality in its physical development, the present race is on its ascending arc, and the sixth will rapidly growing out of its bonds of matter and even of flesh. So this is very interesting. He's pointing here to this upward arc. And in theosophy, usually most developmental criterion is based on increasing levels of responsibility for one's own growth and sense of solidarity with all of life, including other human beings. Now, the seventh race is very mysterious. Rightly then will be the great far western ocean have been named the Pacific. For that race will not be given to contest, nor hear of wars or rumors of war, since it will be too near the seventh. So he's talking a little bit, giving a clue about the seventh, but really doing it via talking about the sixth. The sixth will be so peaceful because it's near the seventh. The mission of the seventh root race must be to attain the consummation, to seize and hold the Holy Grail. Very mysterious. Also, just throwing this in there, as we suggested before, she has this comment about the influence of the moon and the planets, but these are spiritual and metaphysical influences as well as physical, astrological and astronomical. All such geological cataclysms, from the upheaval of oceans, deluges, and shifting of continents down to the present year's cyclones, hurricanes, earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, tidal waves, and even the extraordinary weather and seeming shifting of seasons, which perplexes all European and American meteorologists, so apparently they had extraordinary weather back in her day, are due to and depend upon the moon and planets, and even modest and neglected constellations have the greatest influence on the meteorological and cosmical changes over and within our Earth. Just kind of throw that in the soup. Whatever happens, it's all under karmic law. Karma is a law which acts at its appointed time, and not at all blindly. By the way, we're going back to the secret doctrine. As science may think, but in strict accordance and harmony with karmic law. In occultism, this inexorable law is referred to as the great adjuster. Science confesses its ignorance of the cause producing climactic vicissitudes and such changes in the axial direction, which are always followed by these vicissitudes. Nor does it seem so sure of the axial changes. And being unable to account for them, it is prepared rather to deny the axial phenomenon altogether than admit the intelligent karmic hand and law, which alone could reasonably explain such sudden changes and the results. Now, science has changed since HPB's time. Science refers to this idea that there are obviously not only the precession of the equinoxes, the 25,000 year cycle, but also that these minor vibrations of the top, I would say, that have to do with axial drift, as that they are saying, which again, they are saying moves at a rate of 4 inches per year. But science is fascinated with great events in nature as big explosions and big powerful events. How did the universe come into existence? Well, there was a big bang. What happens when big changes happen on the earth? I don't know, something crashed into the earth, comets. Okay, fine, that must be the case. And there's probably some truth to it if they think that that's the case. But she seems to be pointing here, look at these changes in the axial directions and think about karma. Something to think about. How does karma work? It's the operation of universal intelligence. Karma is an intelligent law. In the black here, it's from The Secret Doctrine, and in the orange here, it's from Judge. HPB says, we prefer holding to our exoteric explanation, esoteric, since Fohat is as good as any comet, having in addition universal intelligence to guide him. So this is giving us a clue as to the connection of the spiritual and moral development of humanity and these cataclysms. Now, the cataclysms are part of nature. Helping nature and working on with her is part of nature. All these things are the things that we will be thinking about throughout the remainder of the day. So then Judge talks about, from the aphorisms on karma, he says, karma operates to produce cataclysms of nature by concatenation through the mental and astral planes of being. A cataclysm may be traced to an immediate physical cause, such as internal fire and atmospheric disturbance, but these have been brought on by the disturbance created through the dynamic power of human thought. Then he says something very mysterious. Egos who have no karmic connection with a portion of the globe where a cataclysm is coming on are kept without the latter's operation in two ways. A, by repulsion acting on their inner nature, and B, by being called and warned by those who watch the progress of the world. And I'm going to refer to two theosophical interventions with reference to possible cataclysms that we are facing right now. And the two interventions have to do with what I'm going to call the first intervention, which is in this case B, being called and warned by those who watch the progress of the world. And the second I'll talk about is having to do with what's going on our in our inner nature. Intervention one, timely help. Timely help is HBB's words. Then we have Judge's aphorisms on karma. Given that the karma of this earth is the combination of the acts and thoughts of all beings of every grade, which were concerned in the preceding manvantara, or evolutionary stream from which ours flows, and given that these beings include lords of power and holy men, as well as weak and wicked ones, the period of the earth's duration is greater than that of any entity or race upon it. I've always looked at this aphorism and I couldn't make the connection. What is going on with these lords of power and holy men, as well as others? And how would that be connected with the period of the earth's duration? We think that it has to do with the continuity of the cycle of learning, that there are given beings who understand that there is a direct relationship between the acts and thoughts of all the beings in any given cycle and the and these cycles. It's like Basunda, once again, sitting in the kalpa tree. There are those who can see all this and who know what's going on. And at certain intervals of initiative, they warn people about impending great changes in the interest of certain continuity, continuity of teaching, continuity of civilization, continuity of some kind of a thread of consciousness that goes from one cycle to the other. So, and then HPB, in her characteristic ways, borrowing from different scientific expressions, the survival of the fittest nations and races are secured through timely help. The unfit ones, the failures, are disposed of by being swept off the earth. I think that the fittest in this, she does irony quite a bit. So the survival of the fittest is not any kind of Darwinism, social or otherwise. Instead, it has to do with the moral fitness and the moral, the capability of humans to transmit the teachings and the truth for future cycles of learning. Another intervention, and this would have to do with what's going on within ourselves. And this again is twofold actually. It's gonna be have to do with what D.K. Mavilar calls overcoming isolation. And then we'll refer to something that I'm gonna call becoming septenary. Selfishness, this is Mavalankar. Selfishness, which is the result of a strong sense of personality, is detrimental to spiritual progress. This it is that constitutes the difference between white and black magic. And it is this tendency to which reference is made when talking of the end of a race. At this period, the whole humanity splits up into two classes, the adepts of the good law and the sorcerers or digpas. To that period, we are fast rushing. This is D.K. Mavalankar. And to save humanity from a cataclysm, which must overtake those who go against the purposes of nature, the Mahatmas, who are working with her, are endeavoring to spread knowledge in a matter to prevent its abuse as far as possible. We should therefore constantly remember that the present is not the apex of evolution, and that if we would not be annihilated, we must not allow ourselves to be influenced by a sense of personal isolation and consequent worldly vanities and shows. So he's making this connection between psychological states of mind and these great cycles, and that there is initiative, there's an intervention going on by these great teachers. Presumably that means the introduction of theosophy as a leavening effect. Also, and this is the becoming septenary phase, HPB and others indicate that there's value in thinking of these seven ages of man as connected with these seven root races, because they're cycles of learning. So there's the cycle of seven. You know, there's theosophically what happens in a child's life at the age of seven, et cetera, 14 years, 21 years, et cetera. But we're going to look at that. Shakespeare has Jacques say in As You Like It, he says, all the world's a stage and all the men and women are merely players. They have their exits and their entrances. And one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. Then in The Secret Doctrine, there's a footnote referring to the wisdom of Hippocrates. And he says, just like Shakespeare does, that the life of man can be divided into seven ages. Hippocrates says, as the moon changes her phases every 7 days, this number seven, influences all sublunary beings and even the earth, as we know. With the child, it is the teeth that appear in the seventh month, and he sheds them at 7 years. At twice seven, puberty begins. At 3 times 7, all our mental and vital powers are developed. At 4 times 7, he is in his full strength. At 5 times 7, his passions are most developed. Isn't that interesting? It is thus so for the earth. The earth and its humanity is now in its middle age. I believe that's referring to this. He's saying that humanity, that we're 35 years old. But we're at the point where we can return. The 35-year mark is the point of the development of all of our systems. Our whole life is in place. And then it's time to return to that which is more spiritual. Humanity, the earth and its humanity, is now in its middle age, yet very little wiser for it. Then there's this extremely mysterious thing, which I don't even begin to want to try and explain. The Tetragrammaton, the four-lettered sacred name of the deity, can be resolved on earth only by becoming septenary through the manifest triangle proceeding from the concealed to tractus. There's this idea of becoming septenary. And I think one aspect of that would be that for humanity to begin to embrace the three higher principles and to begin to identify them. Crosby says, take the position of the reincarnating ego, which is what Basunda is doing in the beginning, sitting there in that kalpa tree, looking at this great cycle of perspective of humanity going through cycles. And there's a Shiva aspect to it where there is regeneration by means of destruction. But are we at a critical place? I'm just going to leave you with a question that says, is civilization going to be destroyed physically, or are we going to begin to help nature and work on with her by beginning to unlearn these habits of isolation and these Epimethean desires that we have, where we're using resources at an alarming rate and therefore changing all of nature and doing things that we didn't expect to do. So I'm sure that the rest of the day we will be able to take a look at these things. I just leave you with this final quote. Judge says that you will remember that wonderful quote at the end of his article, Cycles. He says, arise then, O Atlanteans, and repair the mischief done so long ago. Roll on, O wheel, roll on and conquer, roll on forevermore. Okay, I'm going to try and get it. There we go. Thank you. Steve, you're muted, I think.
We're going to move into our question and answer period for a little bit. There was a chat that came in regarding CO2 released from oceans to reduce the electromagnetic field. The whole point is that we're quoting the article given that we refer to, and that even though the CO2 released from the geomagnetic fields, reducing geomagnetic fields releases CO2 into the Earth's atmosphere, as does volcanoes. It's dwarfed. It's much smaller than the amount that comes from human causes. And so, as was just immediately alluded to, it is perhaps our isolationism and our consumption with the passions and all the consumption of our resources and the way we use the land and fertilizer and the fossil fuels and coals, all these things that are childs of the an early industrial age, 1850 onward. We're reaching at a point where it's beginning to take its toll on the earth in very definite and measurable ways. And of course, humanity, as we will see later on. So we do invite your other questions and comments at this time. We'll try to identify everybody who has a contribution. Yes, Keith. Unmute, please.
Okay. I'd like to take about 3 minutes to make some observations, but I first want to thank you and Jonathan. Dr. Levy, you might recall that I spoke after you at a conference in 2013 in New York. And what you presented today was extremely well done. And that's from my point of view as an environmental attorney, and I've been practicing in this field for a very long time. So that's very much appreciated. And I'm hoping that you'll be able to send out to everyone who is participating is on the email string where these presentations can be seen, because I can't participate the entire day, but I do want to listen to the rest of the presentations for today.
Here, just so I don't forget, the entire conference, including any chats, including the part I gave, is going to be posted on the ULTPhiladelphia.org website as a podcast, video, and audio. And that will be made available to folks. There won't be an announcement that goes out.
Great.
Thank you.
Well, where I wanted to comment is to focus on a comment made by HPB to the American Convention of Theosophists in 1891, where she summarized in the end this. After all, every wish and thought I can utter are summed up in this one sentence, the never dormant wish of my heart. Be theosophists, work for theosophy, theosophy first and theosophy last, for it's practical. And she italicized that practical realization alone can save the Western world from that selfish and unbrotherly feeling that now divides race from race, one nation from the other, and from that hatred of class and social strifes that are the curse and disgrace of so-called Christian peoples. Theosophy alone can save it from sinking entirely into that mere luxurious materialism in which it will decay and putrefy as older civilizations have done. And I'll stop at that comment and point out that there has been an expression for those of us that follow politics that a crisis is something that ought never to be wasted. And we obviously are in a global crisis right now, not only with the issues that have been brought up in this discussion thus far, but of course with the pandemic that the entire world is going through. And it is clear that cooperation among all peoples and all nations will be necessary to resolve these problems. One of the things I find extraordinarily beneficial is the perspective of the United Lodge of Theosophists in how to apply theosophical ideas. One can easily get caught up in some of the abstruse references that we have within the philosophy, but we are also told that if we simply follow our duty as we understand it, and if we try to act for and as the self of all creatures, that will bring us to the goal that we need to work toward both individually and collectively. The other short reference I wanted to make is to a couple sentences from the writer John Ruskin, who was a contemporary of our teachers of theosophy in the 19th century. And one of the things he wrote in this wonderful book, Unto This Last, which was a great inspiration to Gandhi and many others, is he says, there is no wealth but life, life including all its powers of love and joy and of admiration. That country is richest, which nourishes the greatest number of noble and happy human beings. That man is richest who, having perfected the functions of his own life to the utmost, has also the widest helpful influence both personal and by means of possessions on others. A strange political economy, the only one, nevertheless, that ever has or can be. All political economy founded on self-interest, being but the fulfillment of that which once brought schism into the policy of angels and ruin into the economy of heaven. Beautifully put, still inspiring all these years after he wrote it. And I look forward to hearing the rest of the comments and the presentations later today. And I think it is an extraordinarily wonderful thing that this conference has been put together. I think it's off to a wonderful start. Thank you.
Thank you for your contributions, Keith. Jonathan, there's a question that came in, perhaps it's directed to you. Did I understand you correctly that the premature melting of ice at the poles will affect changes of rotation at the poles?
Oh, that was my very small foray into the earth science aspect of this. Because that was in reference to this whole thing about the spinning of the wheel. Remember that in the Secret Doctrine. And that has to do with the wheel, the earth spins at different speeds. And the slower that it speeds, there's more of it comes loose at the ends, as the phraseology in the Secret Doctrine, which is kind of more of a, I would call it more of a vibration. And more of an variation in the spin of the axis. The three references that this earth scientists are saying that has to do with the variation in the tilt of the axis, and they call it axial drift. One of them had to do with the melting of Greenland and the dispersing of that very heavy weight center throughout the entire globe. So, but I would imagine this would affect also with Antarctica, but Antarctica is more closer to the center, whereas Greenland is less closer to the center. So anything in relationship to something that's a little further away from the actual axis itself, that would be less of a, what do you call it, centrifugal motion effect. So I'm not sure that I can answer the question.
Thank you for that. There is a contribution, a statement from the Secret Doctrine in the chat. HPB mentions four Maharajas and Lokapalas who are karmic agents and related to weather cataclysms, pandemics. Thank you for that. And actually, in our next session, we're going to be talking about the deep and hidden ecology of the Earth. And of course, the terms deep ecology is a modern one since the 1970s, and it refers to an appreciation of the inherent value of all living beings. But we're going to explore what is the basis, what's the philosophical, what's the hidden basis of the inherent value of all living beings. And so this subject of intelligence and its work on the functions of nature, the processes of nature, the disturbances of nature will be covered at that time, at least enough to get you interested in your own investigation. It will definitely not be exhaustive. So any other questions or comments at this time? Yes, MHW? Oh.
If, you know, we all know the global warming deniers that, you know, they don't believe any of this is going on. And what they use as a confirmation of their idea is that in so many countries, winters have gotten so much worse. They're getting colder, more snow. So how do we discuss this with somebody? I mean, how do we come back to tell them that these worsening winters are the are as a result of global warming?
Yes, good question. So we refer you back to those images we showed from NASA, and you certainly can review them yourselves and also invite your friends and inquirers to look at them. And you remember where I showed you the satellite images, and you may have noticed that the distribution of global warming and even CO2 and other factors, even the gravitational effects were more intense in certain parts of the world than others. The dark blue areas, if we had time and went back there, you would see there's a cycle and a shifting around the Earth. So weather scientists, climate specialists recognize that there are changes going on. We're going to cover these later, but they're not uniform. Some areas are hit more in other ways. And where there might not be global warming in certain areas, there's flooding or there's more tornadoes. So different areas geographically, because of the nature environment, don't experience drought or heat, but they might experience flooding and other natural disasters. Just as all human beings don't suffer the same way, but according to their inherent vulnerabilities in their natures, they may experience one kind of imbalance versus another. But we saw a hand go up from Lillian.
Yes, I just wanted to thank both you, Steve, and also Jonathan for your really fine presentations. I happen to be a theosophist from Florida, and so probably you haven't seen my face previously. I've only recently had the pleasure of understanding and knowing your website and being on these presentations. But especially the correlation between humanity and the planet and the ages, and it's quite remarkable about the way both of you did your presentation, and it makes it more meaningful, and it kind of really shows us all that we have a really big responsibility here. It's fine to have this information, but we're really kind of obligated to do something about it.
Thank you, Lillian. I'm sure you weren't too pleased with what Miami's going to look like in the next and for that matter, most of the Eastern Seaboard. Kim, yes, I saw your hand.
It's hard to make changes. I know what's good for me, but I do what's expedient. So how do we get everybody on Earth, especially the wealthier nations, to get off fossil fuels?
Yes, very good. Remember, we have questions. What can we do to help? Well, how can we use theosophy? We're gonna bring that in more towards the end. How to get people interested? Let's think locally. We have, right now we have 40 participants. If each one of us tomorrow spoke with one person, just one person, and convinced them to cut down on their fossil fuels, and the next day, each one of those 40 persons, each one of them spoke to another 40, just one person, and convinced them. By the end of the week, every person in the world would have been contacted at least once or twice about that message. Now, it might take a little longer because many of us know the same people, but you get the idea. It only takes a few people making a small change and keeping up that tendency that through that, great changes occur. So don't think about humanity, think about your neighbor, your family, what you can do. Give them access to some of this information. Let them see those pictures of NASA. We'll talk more about what's going on in the remainder. But as Jonathan brought it out in The Secret Doctrine, it tells us that the earth and the water need rest. We do too, so we're gonna take a little bit of a break right now before we get into our next session. So we'll see you in a little bit. We're going to leave, we're going to disconnect we're going to allow you to talk among yourselves and.
Steve?
Yes.
We have to calibrate time.
Yes, we're going to start again in about 10 minutes. 1:45?
Okay, so we've collapsed the long break then.
Yeah, we're going to have to collapse the long break. We're just going to take a 10-minute break now.
Okay.
Okay.
Sorry for talking too much.
Use it well, your break.